going higher and higher. That's what I heard.
Okay, that's what the effect is going for, that it's perpetually getting higher and higher. Obviously, it can only go so high, and then it goes beyond people's ability to hear the pitch. But I could play that tone for an hour and a half and drive everyone insane, and it would seem to be just as much going up as it did in the minute that I played it. So anyone else have any kind of opinions of what's causing this effect? And then I'll just tell you.
I've got a guess, Roy. There is an electronic toy that they use in the RF world called a comb generator, which makes a whole bunch of individual frequencies at a fixed spacing between the two. And if I now played that comb, if I was using comb lines, and let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz, and I played that into a single sideband receiver, and I slowly turned the dial in the single sideband receiver, I could be turning the dial to a lower frequency. Relatively, the tones would be going up in frequency, and as one walks out of the upper edge of the passband, another one kc away is coming in. So I could create a comb generator, an acoustic comb generator, that gives me the effect where I'm always hearing one or two or three tones going up, but because there's another one coming in on the bottom as I turn the dial, it never ends. That's one way I think I could create that signal that you just produced. AC2GS, K2LAW.
Okay, that's probably the best description that I've heard and that I could give, but let me just give you a little detail of what's going on. Originally, there are three tones. They're one octave separated from the top to the middle to the bottom. The top two are being played the loudest. The bottom isn't being played at all. As they all three go up to another octave higher, the amplitude of the highest frequency goes down as the amplitude of the lowest frequency goes up. So by the time it reaches the next octave, you have the second and the third, and the first one isn't playing. They do then introduce another lower octave just like it began and cycle the same way. So you're hearing basically three tones where the highest one is going down in amplitude and the upper one is going up in amplitude and the mid one stays constant during that rise. And it's called a shepherd's note. It's used in the movie industry a lot. It generates suspense because it gives you that concept that it just gets higher and higher and higher and beyond the point where you're used to notes getting higher that long.
I wonder if they ever used that effect on Star Trek, when on some of those scenes they were slowly sliding up to Mach 6, whatever they called it, 6 times the speed, 7 times the speed, 8 times the speed. What's that again?
Warp 6.
Yeah. So they're going to higher and higher warp numbers, and you were hearing that tone in the background letting you know that these engines are making the sound. I wonder if they were ever using that effect during Star Trek. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I kind of, in the back of my mind, remember hearing engine noises revving up for an incredibly long time. So it's an old audio trick that they had in the film industry, and I'm sure they used it a lot in television as well. But it's just an interesting little effect. It didn't work at all on single sideband this morning, because again, all I had was that 3K of bandwidth, and it wasn't enough for people to really appreciate it. To them, it just sounded like a constant tone running.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
The old movie, Forbidden Planet, that's where that sound really sounds very familiar. Not quite, but the same idea. But are these three tones that you're playing, in other words, one tone is playing and it's doing something as it progresses, and then the other one comes in and and does the exact same thing, and then the third one does the exact same thing. In other words, it's just row, row, row your boat with frequencies.
Yeah, basically it's those three frequencies ramping up one octave, and then it goes into repeat. And I must have played four or five cycles of that. And most people can't really tell, for the most part, that it's discontinuous. They feel that it's a continuous thing going on. But our brain kind of tricks us into that.
Very good. I was waiting for the frequency to go so high that my radio was not going to hear it.
Yeah, that's the trick. It keeps going and going and going and never gives up. It's the Energizer Bunny of audiophiles.
No question.
Question away.
If that would need three tones to work properly, like in other words, I see the harmonic intervals, but it could not with two tones. Is that correct? It would take three tones, correct?
You need the three tones because you have to have a constant tone in the middle, and the idea is you're adjusting the amplitude of the highest and the lowest one. If you didn't have the middle one, you'd sort of know something terrible was going on.
Now, that answers my question. Thanks, KD2PBF. Thanks.
Yeah, run this by again, Roy. Was the middle tone always constant in frequency and constant in amplitude, and the low tone and the high tone are the ones that are being changed only in amplitude, not frequency, or both? Run that by again, Roy. Go ahead.
No, all three are going up in frequency. They're all one octave apart, and they're going up at the end of their little travail. They will be one octave higher at the end than when they started. The amplitudes are being twiddled with. The middle one has a constant amplitude. The higher frequency starts off with a high amplitude and fades to nothing at the end. The low frequency starts out with no amplitude and goes to full amplitude at the end, and then it repeats.
Is it a constant rolling motion that as the tones go up in frequency and go out on the high end, so to speak, another one is always being injected at the low end? Is that true?
Exactly. When the lowest of the three goes up an octave, it basically, by repeating the same exact initial sequence, it's as though you introduce another one octave lower frequency and start from scratch. It was basically you're repeating the initial condition over and over and over again without people really noticing what's going on.
Another complicating factor is that the notes are beating against each other, which ordinarily would give you a third or a fourth dissonant note. But because they're exact octaves apart, the beat falls on the frequency of one of the existing notes. Therefore, to some degree, you don't hear the beat. Over to you, Roy. K2IW.
Yeah, that's one of the tricks. There's a lot of ways that our brain is able to figure out if we're being fooled, and that's one of the ways. And by using a full octave, you get around that beautifully. So, yeah, that's why this thing works, and just random selection of starting frequencies would be a mess. By the way, to Eric, I emailed you the file, so hopefully you'll get it.
When you get a chance, I'm going to go back to the previous subject for a minute or two, Roy.
Yeah, sure. Feel free.
Earth has a circumference of a little more than 24,000 miles. At the equator, once per 24-hour day, you could say you're moving 1,020 miles an hour because of Earth's rotation at the equator. Up where we are at 40 degrees north latitude, take the cosine of 40 degrees, 40.8 degrees, and multiply it by the 1,020, the sun is moving 772 miles an hour. So in our vicinity, if you traced where the sub-sun point is on the Earth, that point is moving 772 miles an hour. When Hank is in his airplane flying 500 miles an hour through the east, you add the 772 to the 500, and he comes up with 1,272 miles an hour. When he goes to the west, you separate the 500, you subtract the 500 miles an hour from the 1,020, and you come down to 200 and some odd miles an hour. So in other words, the resultant speed when Hank is in his airplane flying at 500 miles an hour, when he goes to the east or goes to the west, the total velocity he's going is now a huge difference. Therefore, in theory, a person weighing his weight on that airplane when he's flying straight and level at a constant altitude, there should be a difference in weight when you fly to the east versus fly to the west that I think would be measurable. What do you think, Roy? AC2GS, K2LIW?
I would agree. It's basically the same type of thing as the Iotvos effect, except that you've extended it up some elevation, so you've decreased the person's weight simply because they're farther away from the center of gravity. But for the same principle, when he's flying east, he weighs less. When he's flying west, he weighs more.
I wonder if the pilot on the SR-71 ever noticed this effect. One of the events that took place on the SR-71 is they wanted to find out how fast it could fly from Washington to California, to the Los Angeles area, Los Angeles area. And they took off right after sunset, and as they flew across the Earth at 2,200 miles an hour, they saw the sun rise again to the west. So they went through a day in which they saw at least two sunsets, as I remember, and there may have even been more complication to it. So when you're flying at 2,200 miles an hour in an SR-71 and you go east or west, boy, there could be a huge difference in your weight. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I guess it has to do with velocity, but I mean, in case of normal velocities on the ground or something, it really wouldn't put that much of a difference. I mean, you know, these things are all rather theoretical, and I think if you got into a very fast train and went east, you might lose about either a tenth of a percent or two tenths of a percent of your weight on a scale. So it's not that extreme. I mean, as you increase the velocities, they get stranger. But I wonder if that was really a factor. I'm sure there are a lot of other things that happen at high velocity that worry them a lot more otherwise.
There are two equations that are used for centripetal force. Omega squared R or V squared over R. But in either case, you take the velocity and square it. So if you're in a 50-mile-an-hour automobile and you add that to the Earth's speed at this latitude of 770 miles an hour, you add the 50 and square the result, or subtract the 50 and square the result. Because it's in a velocity-squared phenomenon, I suspect it's a little more measurable than first meets the eye. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Perhaps, I don't know. I haven't read that much about that aspect. I mean, I'm sure if you get an airplane into a fast enough speed, you might be able to get it into orbit. So that's effectively doing some strange things with a person's weight. So, I'm sure in extremes you can do a lot of interesting things, but I don't know if they really think in terms of weight or there's other engineering terms that they use for all of these effects. And then you have the problem that this is really centrifugal force, which isn't a real force, it's a pseudo force, because it's really inertia and gravity doing it. Centripetal force is a real force, but centrifugal with an F is a pseudo force.
Parabolic. Sorry to make a comment, but that would have something to do with it also. The spiral around the Earth, you're actually almost always going down. Sorry for the comment.
What I think he's saying is that when you travel at a constant latitude, you're not traveling by a great circle path. So there's another factor going on here. If you trace a path on a globe at constant latitude, it is not a straight line on the globe. You can stretch a piece of string between the starting point and the end point, and you cannot adjust that string to be constant in latitude. The navigation required to do that is called rum line navigation. Could you write KQIW?
Yeah, okay. I don't know that much about aviation, but it's sort of interesting how, you can go north until a certain point, and how do you travel north from the North Pole, aside from the fact that magnetic north isn't quite the same as the North Pole? Okay, any other comments or questions about anything that I've so far done or that Dick has mentioned?
There's a puzzle that's often used, that a person starts at a particular point on planet Earth, travels due south, let's say 10 miles. Then he goes due east 10 miles. Then he goes due north 10 miles. And he has ended up at the exact same spot where he started. Where on Earth would that happen? And the answer is, if you started at the North Pole, that exactly would happen. Or the South Pole. Anywhere else on Earth, you would not end up at the same place you started. W. Roy, KGIW.
Yes, geometry can be fascinating. I mean, the guys like Pythagoras made a damn religion out of it. They had all these concepts that atoms and such were made out of fundamental shapes. That those guys thought that iron was designed with little hooks in them, and that was the thing for why iron was so strong. So different geometries have different qualities, and they're sort of fascinating. They're good to imagine and think of. I mean, everyone has seen a map, but it's really problematic to reduce a sphere into a flat map. It leads to distortion. And I'm sure that there's still a bunch of people who think that Greenland is enormous. I'm alluding to the fact that the distortions of some versions of flat maps cause the North and the South Pole areas to seem incredibly larger, because effectively what you're doing is turning it into a rubber membrane and just stretching it across XY. That's what I'm alluding to. Okay, let's try something completely different. There's something called a Feynman sprinkler, which actually good old Mach wrote about. And his big question when he was going to college, it ran through the physics department. Everyone has seen a garden sprinkler. The question is, what would happen if you stuck a garden sprinkler in a water bath and sucked the water out instead of pushing it through the hose? What would happen to the sprinkler? There's not that many options. It would either go in the same direction that the sprinkler usually goes, or it would do nothing, or it would go in reverse.
Which sprinkler? The oscillating ones, or the ones that just spin around?
Non-oscillating simple ones, the ones with right angle contours, spokes, if you will.
I say it's going to sit still, Roy.
Okay, I'm voting for the other two, any of the other two options.
say is rotate the opposite way.
Okay, does anyone say it rotates forward? Now, the story goes that Richard Feynman actually set this up in Princeton's lab and basically flooded the lab because of the pressure built up in his apparatus too much beyond the glass tank that was the sprinkler, and the entire lab was flooded. And they never actually tested the theory out until many, many years later.
If he really did it underwater, and the water was running out, we know the sprinkler is going to turn in the conventional direction. But then when he sucks water back in, I say it doesn't move. And the explanation between the two is a little bit crazy, but that's what I think is going to happen. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, the answer of it not moving usually involves the increased viscosity of water. That a sprinkler is out in the air is not very viscous, there's really no drag to speak of, and so you have the force of water falling out of it, and you have relatively non-viscous air, and so you have a nice motion. So if you reverse it in a water environment with the viscosity and such, it would probably decrease the motion to the point where friction and such wouldn't let the darn thing turn. Is that your idea?
No, it is not. I could take that sprinkler in air, force high-speed air through it, it will turn in the conventional direction. I then put a very high-speed vacuum pump on it. It will sit still. And I'll give you an explanation for why a little bit later. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, to the edge. I said it would sit still also.
Okay, so two people for sit still, one per person for reverse. Anyone want to make any other comment? Okay, now once again, there are actual YouTubes of guys who have a lot of free time who set this thing up and demonstrated it. And if you can finesse the friction and the viscosity problems and make everything run very, very smoothly and very well balanced, it will actually run in reverse. So that's what they're showing on the videos, and I'd be interested, Dick, what would cause it not to. I mean, I don't know.
Okay, there's a double explanation. I'm first going to give the simple one. I've got a can of compressed air, and I poke my ice stick into one end of the can. Air is squirting out of the can. That air squirting out of the can is like a jet engine, and if that can was on a very low friction car or on a very low friction boat in water, it would move in the conventional direction. So compressed air in the can, poke a hole, you get a jet engine, and you get the motion you would expect. Now do the opposite. Start off with a can that's got perfect vacuum inside. Poke a hole in it, and as the air rushes into the can, which direction does the can move, Roy? AC2GS, K2RAW?
Towards the hole?
In steady state, the answer is no. During the first millisecond, yes, it'll move toward the hole. But steady state, assume now I've got a great big long can with a whole lot of vacuum inside. It's going to take 30 seconds to fill it up with air again. It does not move. The reason for that is that when you had high pressure air in the can and you squirted it out, the air molecules you squirted out had the ability to go to infinite distance if they wanted to. So you really got thrust out of them. You were taking a massive component, accelerating it out the hole, and therefore you're getting action and reaction. When there's a vacuum in the can, in the steady state, all the air molecules running into that hole go into the can and slam against the back wall. The net result of momentum change is zero, except for the first millisecond before those air molecules traverse that distance. You get no thrust in reverse. And therefore,
there's a similar phenomenon going on with the sprinkler, but let's just chew on this one first. Ain't that crazy that the vacuum can will not give you continuous thrust? Over to you, Roy.
Okay, I agree with the vacuum can because it's self-contained, but this thought experiment is basically about a pumping water out of the tank through the garden sprinkler. So it's not a steady state situation. It's a dynamic situation.
Okay, a conventional circular sprinkler in a water tank, and you're pumping water into the sprinkler. You're getting two phenomena going on. One is you're getting a jet action of the water coming out of the tips of the sprinkler. That gives you some thrust. You're also getting water going down the spoke of the sprinkler, going to the right angle turn before it goes out the hole of the sprinkler. That also gives you a thrust in the same direction. So the thrust to rotate the sprinkler, some of it is the water making the right angle turn, and some of it is the jet action at the end of the sprinkler. When you reverse the sprinkler and now you're sucking water in, yes, you're getting partial vacuum of water at the tip of the sprinkler, but the water that now goes into that right angle turn is doing the opposite motion. It's like the air molecules slamming against the back wall of the can. The water molecule, the water droplets circling that right angle turn are giving you thrust in the other direction, and the two cancel. So done carefully, I think the sucking water sprinkler does not move. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Okay. There were a lot of great theories back in Feynman's college, and I don't know. So far, the only videos that I've seen, and I've seen about three or four of them, all pretty much show that when they start to suck the water out of the tank, the little sprinkler goes counterclockwise. So I don't know. It sounds like a great explanation, but it doesn't seem to apply to these YouTube videos unless they've been tricked.
Let's talk about rates. When the water was squirting at, let's say, 1 gallon per minute, you got a certain rotational rate out of that sprinkler. But when it was sucking, if you got any rotation at all, I bet it was a very small fraction of that rate, Roy. Go ahead.
Well, by recollection, I mean, it might have been equivalent, but it was something like 80 or 70% or something like that. But it wasn't significantly equivocal. I've seen videos where kind of things wobble about and people make predictions, you know, especially about, you know, every so often someone will take a camera into a bathroom and flush a toilet and talk about why the water is running clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on what kind of strange theory they might have.
Yeah, there was another person that wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, that other person.
KD2DRG. I would think that you would have to, if you're going to get any movement in reverse at all, it would have to be with a much greater force than you use to get the vanes to spin going forward. KD2DRG. I'm not an engineer. I'm just off the top of my head. It was designed to do one thing in one direction, not the other. So I think if you apply the equal force in the reverse direction, I don't think you'd get any result. If you increased it, I think you might maybe get some movement, but I don't see it happening with the same pressure in reverse. KD2PHV.
Okay. Again, I don't really know the specifics. It's just it was a big question that Feynman used to talk about, and even Ernst Mach back in the 1800s mentioned it. And I don't know. There's other problems. There's viscosity. There's friction. There's all manner of complications once you take the standard sprinkler and put it in a tank of water. But I don't know. It does go backwards. If it goes backwards with half the force or a quarter of the force or a third of the force, I can't tell you because I don't know the numbers, but it is possible to go in the opposite direction.
energy. Very cool. It's interesting stuff, Dr. Roy. I enjoyed immensely. So back to that, KD2DIG.
Okay, let me just give you a little bit of physics news. Let me drop. Just to kind of indicate what kind of wacky world we live in. We've been talking off and on about what pressure is and what pressure does. And recently, they've done some great experiments to find the oppressive pressures inside a proton. The force that is exerted that is equaled by the strong nuclear force of the gluon. And they found that, amazing as it sounds to me, the pressure inside of a proton is 10 times the pressure in a neutron star. And you can imagine that neutron stars have a lot of pressure in them. So the lowly little proton that you're filled with are incredibly in ridiculous pressures. So it just goes to show you how wacky quantum mechanics can be.
I think there's something we can expand on here, Roy. In the case of a nucleus of an atom, say for instance a helium atom, you've got two protons and two neutrons. Those two protons are very highly positively charged, and they're being rammed against each other. They want to repel like crazy. So we talk about the strong force and the weak force. I believe it's the strong force that causes those two protons to stay together in that nucleus. They want to push apart. And there is another force, strong or weak force, which takes the quarks. You've got three quarks in each neutron, and you've got three quarks in each proton. And the three quarks in the proton, they want to repel each other because they've got a charge. So the quarks being held together in a proton, is that the strong or the weak force? And the two protons themselves being held together in the nucleus, I think they're held there by the strong force. So I'm always having a little bit of trouble.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm always having a little bit of trouble contrasting the strong force and the weak force. You've studied this a lot more than I have, Roy, so please give us your words on strong force and weak force. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS. Both of these forces that you've been talking about are mediated by the strong nuclear force. Quarks bind, gluons bind quarks together. Gluons are the mediating force carriers of the strong nuclear force. They also mitigate the attraction and holding together of the nucleus. Unfortunately, you can't do what you suggested you might be able to do, which is to keep two positively charged protons together in a nucleus happy. That's why God invented neutrons. Neutrons are the intermediary. They contain positively and negatively charged quarks. Although their net charge is zero, they're a complex structure. And so they're like a lollipop with multiple layers. The inside is negative, the middle is positive, and the outside is negative. And the net charge is zero, but the strong nuclear force allows them to mediate between the protons and to keep the nucleus together. But it's all the strong force. The weak force is only mediates radioactive decay. The other two forces that you talked about were all strong force related.
Okay. The weak force mediates radioactive decay. What is the weak force really doing? What is it holding? What is the weak force working against? What is it holding together?
When you're dealing with a particle that's unstable because it doesn't have enough neutrons to balance the protons and such, the way that the atom decays into beta particles, alpha particles, what have you, tends to be mediated by the weak nuclear force. The intermediates of the weak nuclear force have very strange names. I think one is called the W boson, and the other weak nuclear force intermediary escapes me. But they're involved in how unstable atoms decay into these subatomic particles that fly out of an atom.
Yes, W and Z particle, W particle and Z particle, may be what you're trying to think of. I have the impression the strong force only operates over a very short distance. If I start pushing two protons together, they're going to repel. Until I get them extremely close, and I thought it was the strong force that keeps them together, you're saying the neutrons are required to do it. So I think you're saying there is no nucleus of an atom of more than one particle that doesn't have a neutron in there. There's no way you can have more than one particle without at least a single neutron. And there are atoms which have a very unbalanced number of neutrons. Does that make them less stable? Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
It depends. It's a very complicated bit of quantum mechanics of what makes for a stable a nucleus and what doesn't. But if you just go down the periodic table, unfortunately, I mean, the only thing that has one proton and no neutrons is hydrogen. Once you go to the next element, that's helium, you can't find a helium that doesn't have at least one neutron. Helium-3 has one neutron. Helium-4 has two neutrons. So you need mediation of the neutrons. It's using the strong nuclear force, but just the strong nuclear force is not going to be enough to keep naked positive protons together without something like a neutron to work as an intermediary. But it's done under gluons. The strong force, and it is very, very limited distance. It's the strongest force, but it's the most short-range force that we have.
Is a helium-3 less stable than a helium-4? And a helium-4, I think, is a very stable atom.
Yeah, I think helium-3 is a stable atom as well. It doesn't really correlate with the number of neutrons equals the stability. It has more to do with other complications that are difficult to explain, describe, or to calculate. I think a lot of times it's simply experimental evidence of things.
Now, in the case of a deuteron, a hydrogen atom which has a neutron, you can now add a neutron in there. And there is a tritium where you can add two neutrons in there. I was about to ask you, are there any atoms that have a greater number of neutrons than protons? I guess I just answered my own question. Tritium is one of those. Huh. Is tritium with three neutrons more stable than monohydrogen? Oh, you're right, K2RIW.
No, it isn't. I have a nice little keychain that I got from China on eBay that has a little bit of phosphorus material, and it's a little teeny bit of tritium in it, and it glows all day and all night and will for years to come. Tritium is a radioactive material. It decays. So in that state, one extra neutron is just too many neutrons. Deuterium is quite stable, and obviously regular hydrogen is very stable. But tritium is unstable.
What's your guess as to the half-life of tritium?
I think it's something like a couple of years, because usually these little gadgets are good for about 5-6 years by the time the half-lives add up and you don't get much light from them. I could look it up.
Question.
Ask your question.
Okay, so compasses have a radioactive material that makes them glow at nighttime, and yet it does not affect the correlation to north. Do you know what that is? Is that iridium?
By the way, tritium's half-life is 12 and a half years. I just looked it up. They have used numerous types of material for glowing in the dark instruments. Back in the bad old days, they used radium. And there was a whole bunch of problems. They had young women paint the radium on the hands of the watch, and they would wet it in their tongues. And after a few years, there would be this large number of young women with head and neck cancers. So they swapped out of that. They moved on to other radioactive materials like tritium-based dyes. Lately, my understanding, they've gone totally for phosphorescent materials that kind of soak up light and get locked off in a forbidden transition zone, so it can take minutes, sometimes hours, for it to discharge the energy back into photons. I don't think they're using that much radioactive material anymore, for obvious reasons.
Question answers, Ray. Thanks, KD2PPF. Thank you.
Hydrogen with a neutron added to its nucleus. I guess we call that the deuterium. And if I make water out of that, H2O, we call that heavy water. Is it safe to drink heavy water? Is question number one. And if I made water out of tritium, I suspect that is not safe to drink. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, worst things worse. The ditritium oxide would probably be a terrible thing to drink, again, because its radioactive decay is going to release alpha particles all in your body, which will kill billions and billions of cells, and you'll die of radioactive poisoning. Deuterium is different. Deuterium is stable, but deuterium is heavier than water, and so chemical reactions become different in a deuterium oxide milieu instead of a regular water. So the physics of the chemistry of biology go askew. If you give someone a small amount of deuterium oxide, you know, heavy water, it won't harm them. If you exchange a lot of their water for heavy water, a lot of chemical reactions will just go wacky on you. And it could be terminal. You could theoretically, it would be a very expensive way to kill someone. A very long-winded way of killing someone, but it would eventually kill them.
I wonder what that death would be like. Would it be a pneumonia-like disease?
I would assume it would be multi-organ failure because, well, water is permeable. Once you get it into one place, it goes all over the place. And so within a very short period of time, you would equilibrate your amount of deuterium oxide throughout your body, and all your cells would be deeply confused. And so all your organs would fail almost simultaneously. It would not be fun.
I'm guessing, Roy, and you're going to correct me on this one, that quite a few of the procedures that go on with inside of a human being are really, what would you call it now, osmosis-like. A fluid is flowing through a membrane, correcting for saline magnitude and whatever. So I think there's a fair amount of osmosis going on within a human being. I suspect that heavy water behaves differently on that osmosis. That may be one of the mechanisms that gets fouled up. A guess on my part. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, yes, there's a lot of passive osmosis, but there's a lot of active transport as well. There's a lot of energy-requiring channels in all cells, the sodium, calcium, potassium channels that go against the gradient. So there's a lot of... It's a very busy lab. I mean, I'm always amused by conversations of nanotechnology like someone just thought of it 30 years ago. It's basically us. We're nanotechnology. We're trillions and trillions of little machines running simultaneously, and they all pretty much have to work for us to work. So it's more complicated. Most likely a lot of chemical reactions that we take for granted that go on in each and every one of our cells would act in a slightly different equilibrium point, and that would kind of back everything up, and before long there'd be not enough of the right chemicals in the right place to do the right thing.
Another crazy characteristic of a human being is that we really are one huge hotel. Inside of our gut is a huge number of living organisms. The biome, or whatever it's called, is a huge amount of bacteria-like things in your gut, which I think are required. If your gut was completely sterile, I think the majority of digestion would not work correctly. And so those organisms in our gut probably would also get very disturbed by heavy water. WROY, KJRIW.
Yeah, I would agree. They would find it no fun either. As surprising as it might sound, although bacteria is much smaller than the size of our human cells, we have 10 times as many bacterial cells on or in our body than we have human cells. So figure that one out. And they're mostly in the large intestine. There's some in the gut. And they do, they are required for proper functioning of our our GI system. And in fact, recently there have been studies and people have introduced bacteria into people by route of, you can imagine where they got it from, and they give it to them as pills to introduce bacteria into their colon.
So to make sure a person has the right bacteria to create the correct health, I think you take a healthy person and you take some of his bacteria from his colon, and by one of at least two different methods, you introduce that bacteria into the sick person in order to correct things. I think I've read a few stories about that. On the surface, it sounds uncomfortable, but if it cures certain diseases, like irritable bowel syndrome or something like that, it could be an awful good solution in some cases. Is that true, Roy? KJRIW?
Yes, it seems to be rather effective. The problem with anything that's new is people have a difficult time first warming up to the idea. When blood transfusions were new, there were a lot of people, threatening. Terrible things would happen if you took blood out of a person's body, or if you took in blood from another person. So I guess we're feeling the same easiness of that type of a transfusion for obvious reasons. But it's been found to be rather effective, and we've learned more and more that the type of bacteria is different in people who eat different things, people different environments, who have different health situations. So if anything, there's going to be much more of that down the line.
During a blood transfusion, I suspect that there's a strong need for a matching blood type, that if you infuse the wrong blood type into a person, depending on how much, I suspect that's potentially lethal. So in the beginning, when they didn't know blood types and they were doing infusion, I bet you they blamed all kinds of things because they hadn't yet recognized the different types of blood. Over to you, Roy, for any explanation on this. KJRIW.
Yeah, I mean, blood typing was an important breakthrough early on in blood transfusion. We basically have three. You have A, you have B, and you have a kind of empty null or zero. Or O. And then to complicate things, you have something called the rhesus factor, which is usually designated plus or minus. It's the rhesus factor that was getting pregnant women into trouble. If they were rhesus negative and their child in their womb was rhesus positive, during their pregnancy, the barrier would be breached, and some of the babies of a rhesus factor would get into their system. They'd build up an immunity, and then unfortunately, if their next child was rhesus factor positive, these women's immune system would attack the fetus. So that it's A, B, O, plus and minus.
If you mismatch any of those factors and give it a small amount of injection, can the body recover from that? In other words, when you use the wrong type of blood type, is there a critical amount that can get you in trouble? Over to you, Roy, KJRIW.
Well, most probably, if you need to give a blood transfusion, you need to give a significant amount of blood, so, because otherwise it's a waste of the blood and a risk to a person. But there are tricks of the trade. In a perfect world, if you're A positive, you should get A positive blood. And they won't even do the A positive thing. They'll actually have small vials of the blood that they'll extract, put it in with your blood sample, mix it around, and see if it clots up. But you can get away with universal donors. An O negative is a universal donor. Theoretically, it doesn't have any antigens. The rhesus factor positive is the antigen. The A and B are antigens. So the person with O minus has no antigen. So theoretically, they're a universal donor. You can give it to almost anyone and not have any bad effects.
Interesting. Isn't there also a way of injecting plasma, which is maybe a more neutral fluid, as long as you don't have to need a whole lot of it? Do they ever do a plasma injection, Roy? Go ahead.
There are a lot of other pieces of blood, types of blood elements that they give separately. They give fresh frozen plasma. If a person has a clotting disorder, that's usually the best approach. For people who have a significant platelet problem, they spin down the platelets and they give packets of just the platelets. Those don't have the typing problems, so they're less problematic. It's the red blood cells that get you into trouble. You know, people who have lost enough blood, that's where you carry your oxygen. So you have to get back the red blood cells. That's where typing is crucial.
There was a ham radio operator who I communicated with quite a bit way back in 1970, who was an anesthesiologist working at Downstate Medical Center. And one of the things that had recently been discovered, which seems a little bit strange now, is that during operation procedures, occasionally a blood infusion was required. And in the old days, they would take refrigerated blood and inject it into the person. They soon realized that was creating a thermal shock to the system, that they had to first heat the blood before injecting it. And I think that was discovered somewhere around 1970, I guess on my part. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Well, that was before my time. We didn't per se heat it. We didn't serve it cold, if you will. We got it from the blood bank, and we just kind of put our hands and heated it with our own body temperature. It didn't take that long. And, you know, by the time that everything got set up, you know, you had to travel from one point to another, we were able to heat it up. We didn't have to microwave it. It never got that bad.
But I'm guessing the method of heating you're describing is only bringing it up to room temperature. In the best of all worlds, you'd like to inject it at 98.6, 37 degrees centigrade. Go ahead.
I guess it has to do with the rate of the transfusion. I was not really that much into surgery. I had most of my training in internal medicine. So we were transfusing a bag of blood over 6 to 8 hours. You know, in the trauma units and such, you're just pouring the stuff down them. So I guess it's incredibly more important. It was never really a problem on the internal medicine floors because the rate of infusions were never dramatic like that.
We're probably getting a little too medical, and maybe some people are uncomfortable with that. Maybe you should go to your next puzzle, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay. We were talking about buoyancy at one point. Let's fall back to buoyancy. Everyone knows that if you fly in a hot air balloon, it's this big fabric, and it has a burner below it, and you turn it on, and you heat up the air, and you go fly. So my little riddle for the audience is, what would happen if you put the burner inside the balloon and sealed it up? Would it go up? Would it go down? What would it do?
It would have a hard time finding enough oxygen to burn, I think. KC2, I see Joe.
You are quite correct, and just for the sake of not complicating things, I will just create spontaneously a constant heat source that doesn't require any fuel whatsoever. It just heats up this ball of normal temperature gas. So basically the premise is you have this sphere. It doesn't expand. It doesn't contract. It stays at the same volume. You're on the ground. It's a sealed-up balloon, and you turn the temperature on the generator that's inside the sealed balloon. Just, you know, I'd like people to kind of guesstimate if they got anywhere with something like that. Because it's hot air, right?
JXM.
N2H3R would probably go down because you would need to replenish the air, the atmosphere. You're not only sending heat up, but you're replenishing the air also into the balloon.
Okay. Had wanted to say something?
WB2GXM, it would go up.
Okay, so one's for down, one's for up. Anyone else?
I have a Laplace equation on this fixed volume balloon, and you're turning on a heater inside. The Laplace equation will allow you to calculate the surface tension. There's a high probability you're going to burst that balloon unless it's made out of extremely strong stuff. The Laplace equation says that when the radius of the object is large, an extremely small change in fluid pressure makes a huge difference in surface tension of the container. That's the reason why an aneurysm in a human being is so dangerous. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yeah, I agree, but this is purely for the sake of simplification. We're not talking about the world at all, because no one would want to do what I'm posing. But I was interested in people, because you usually are told that you go into a hot air balloon, you heat the balloon, hot air rises, and you got hot air in this enclosure. I just wanted to know if people thought it rises, because that's what people say about hot air balloons usually.
If the volume is fixed, I don't think it's going to rise.
I'm with him. If the volume is fixed, when you turn on that heater, you get a lot higher pressure inside, but no change in buoyancy is my guess. Over to you, Roy.
Hey, you guys are too smart for me. Anyone else with any other comments about this? Okay. There's a couple little complications that hot water balloons... hot air balloons operate on. Normal hot air balloons, you apply the heat, the air gets hot, it rises up, but the pressure goes up again. And so what happens when you have higher pressure in your hot air balloon? Well, the hot air goes out of the balloon at the bottom, and you're left with a bag that is at the same pressure as the outside, but now it's at a lower density. And buoyancy and density, that causes things to go up. So if you enclose the same space and heat it up, so you have hot air, but you now have hot air at a higher pressure and the same exact density that it was when it was cooler air. And so if you sealed it up, you wouldn't have buoyancy, the wouldn't go up. So that's just my two cents on hot air balloons, and no one usually talks about the hot air kind of escaping out the sides to equalize the pressures.
What I think you're saying, Roy, when you first turn on that hot air balloon, you're creating a column of hot air in the center of that opening in the bottom. That column of hot air goes to the top of the balloon because the total amount of expansion of the air inside is increasing. There's got to be cold air coming back down on the outer perimeter of that hole at the bottom in the beginning of the heating process. That's what I think you're saying, K2LIW.
Well, initially, yes, but obviously over time it equilibrates. So eventually you will reach a point where there's not that much of a differential in the temperature. There'll be a slight increase of the hot air going up and the cool air going down. But the overall pressure pressure of the air is to drive it out through the only opening it has.
And I think the volume that the air occupies is a function of the absolute pressure in kelvins of that air. If you double the kelvins, I think you double its volume. K2IW.
I'm a little confused. Pressure in kelvins? You mean pascal?
We know that as you heat air, it expands. The next question is, how much does it expand? And expansion really means you've measured its volume before you've heated it, and you measure the volume after you've heated it. Well, after you've heated it, it's at a higher temperature. The magnitude of expansion is a function of absolute temperature.